It's a growl in blues. Blues can really growl. I really like the way it sounds. Hi there. My name is Greg Swan. I run a website called selfadoration.com. I published a book or made available a book, promulgated a book called Man Alive, a survival manual for the human mind. And I am laughing at myself. I live my life on black 13 on the roulette wheel. I don't believe in gambling. I think gambling is a waste of money, but when we go to Las Vegas, and we haven't been to Las Vegas for 5 years, but when we go to Las Vegas, we always go to, it's now called Bill's Gambling Hall. It used to be called the Barbary Coast. And we always find a seat at a roulette wheel, and we always play black 13. My wife's birthday is December 13th, and I'm hugely scornful of everything associated with superstition or any sort of irrational means of apprehending reality, so it's delightful for me to challenge the fates by betting on bad luck, betting on the number 13, betting on black 13, roulette pays 36 to 1, 35 to 1, or something like that, and we always win, And you can't always win when you gamble, and if you go into any gambling situation with the idea that you must win, then you must lose, because gambling is always a negative expectation game. All forms of gambling are negative expectation in the long run. Poker can be positive expectation. If you're really good at it, you can actually make a profit at poker. Typically, people who think they're winners at poker, if they actually did the money, did the numbers on their money, they discover that they're losers. Because of the rake, frankly, because the house is the only winner. If you want to make money, if you want to win at gambling, stand on the other side of the table. The side of the table that you typically stand on is the loser side. It's the sucker side. But I have my whole life stacked up in the biggest stack of chips I can make, all of them on black 13, and I'm watching that wheel spin round and round and round and round and hoping that the payoff will come. I would not recommend this as a strategy, especially not as a gambling strategy, but not necessarily as a strategy for life either, that typically you're better off spreading your bets, but I really don't have that option. I chose to take on the entire world, and the only way to do that, frankly, is to put all your money on one bet and see what happens. And it's funny to me, and I have to laugh at myself, because I went into this expecting that the consequences for me would be sudden, dramatic, and not necessarily positive. That I put this off for a lot of years. I put off the message that I'm trying to convey to you in Man Alive. I put off for most of my adult life. I knew what I had to say. I knew very young. I was 19 when I started thinking about these ideas, and by the time I was 24, I had basically everything worked out in essentially the same form that it exists today. If I went back and read things that I wrote in those days, I might find things that I would want to change, but 1988, so how old was I in 1988, 28 or so, I had written out everything in a way that is largely satisfying to me today. There are things that I might quibble with, but they would basically be quibbles, and the big picture I completely understood by the time I was 28 years old, and I'm 52 years old now, so I've been sitting on this stuff for a long time, and frankly, the reason I've been sitting on it is because I was afraid. I was scared, and I'm not scared now, really, I guess, because I don't feel like I have anything left to lose. That was me and Bobby McGee. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, and I don't particularly care for that representation of freedom, but I do understand the idea of having nothing left to lose, and it really doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me what happens in consequence of this. The only thing that really matters to me, frankly, is indifference, and that's the fate I'm suffering. So it's funny. There are thousands of people who have read this book by now, and I mean, I honestly don't know. I deliberately didn't measure, because this is the kind of the worst thing you can do when you're an author is try to sit on eggs. Try to hatch eggs by sitting on them. And so I deliberately didn't put any sort of counter on The Book of Man Alive. I have no idea how many people have seen it on the web in HTML form or in PDF form or in the ebooks form. There are a lot of different ways you can get the book. And I don't know how many people have seen it, but I know that thousands have, and I know that some of those thousands have read it very carefully, and I know from my email that some people have been deeply moved by it and have made serious changes in their lives because of it, but frankly, I was expecting a hostile reaction, and I haven't seen it. And mistakenly, I think in my part, I've kind of tried to tease that hostile reaction out of people, and I'm not going to do that anymore, because it's certainly not what I'm looking for in life. It's not what the book is about. It's not what my attitude is about, and I want people to win. I don't want them to lose. I want them to succeed, to prosper, to thrive. And I don't want them to identify any value in, you know, damning me or criticizing me or blaming me for leading people down the garden path or something like that. I mean, I suppose that will happen, and I can't avoid it. I can't escape it. And if it does, it does. But it's not something that I want to court, because it's not something that I'm interested in. There's no benefit to me in that. There's no value to me in that. And so I'm just laughing at myself. I'm just watching that wheel spin round and round and round, and the ball is spinning in the opposite direction, bouncing, bouncing, bouncing. And every chip I have, everything I have, everything I have in the world is on black 13. And if black 13 comes in, three cheers for me. And if it doesn't, dang. That's my answer, is dang. I'm going to do what I do. I'm going to live my life my way. I'm going to pursue my own values to the absolute best extent that I can. And at that point, I'm going to wait and see what happens. And I don't believe in luck. I don't believe in fate. I don't believe in destiny. I don't believe in any of that crap. And yet, I've done everything that I can think of that I can do in my own behalf. And now I'm kind of stuck waiting to see what happens next. And the wheel goes round and round. And here I am watching it. Me and Blaise Pascal. The wheel has no memory. As usual, I have a number of topics that I want to cover, and as is true for the last 3 weeks, I want to talk about the subjunctive, because it just keeps coming up. There are more and more ways that it comes up. The subjunctive is a grammatical construction. It refers to worlds not in evidence. So if I say, when your grandma gets here, or do you remember your last birthday party, or what can I expect at our meeting tomorrow, or what might happen if I get a flat tire on the way to Flagstaff, these are all subjunctive constructions. They describe worlds not in evidence. The subjunctive is distinguished from the existential. The existential is what is really happening, what really happened, what really exists. So I can hypothesize a rock that I can eat and digest with no consequences to my body. But there is no such rock in existential reality. If it's big enough to be called a rock, it's much too big for me to eat. And if I do try to eat it, I will damage my teeth, I will damage my throat, my esophagus, I will damage my digestive system. Presumably, maybe that will pass through my system, but it will not happen without damage. And so, in that case, I'm invoking a subjunctive condition that cannot possibly exist. And typically, we don't do that. Typically, what we do is we invoke the subjunctive in ways that could exist, might exist, potentially could exist, but don't exist right now. And then the question is the invocation of the subjunctive productive, or is it destructive? Is it destructive of your mental state? And so, I've mentioned the idea of dread, because dreading is something that people do habitually. They dread all kinds of things that never will happen, will never, ever, ever happen. And yet they feel that if they don't count all the pennies they don't have, they won't have any pennies. Well, the fact is, the pennies that you don't have don't exist, and it doesn't matter how many which ways you count them, they still will not show up in your pocket. They won't be there. If you want pennies in your pocket, you need to be thinking about what you could and should be doing to generate income, not thinking about all of the different ways that you could not generate income, or that you could lose the money that you have, or that things could go wrong. Anything could go wrong. It's completely plausible. There is a degree to which dread can be valuable. And so I mentioned, what happens if I get a flat tire when I'm driving to Flagstaff? Well, if I drive from Phoenix to Flagstaff, I'm driving through a whole lot of desert. And this has happened to us. We've broken down on the way to Flagstaff and spent 4 hours out in the middle of the day, in the middle of the summer, in the heat of the desert, hot, 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 inadequate supply of water, cell phones not working because we're so far out in the middle of nowhere, nothing to eat except leftover peppermints given out by Mexican restaurants, waiting first for a cop to come along, and the cop is covering hundreds of square miles of territory, and so it was forever for him to come to us, and then he was able to radio in to get AAA to come out and deal with this, and we're waiting another couple of hours for that. This could happen, and so were we well prepared? We were not. We were not. Unfortunately, it was just me and Kathleen, my wife, just two adults, and we were prepared enough. We were fine for the situation that we were in, but suppose we had had an infant in the car. Not a baby, not a child, not a toddler, but an actual infant, you know, 6 days old, 10 days old, 14 days old. Would we have been adequately prepared? No. And that infant could have suffered serious health consequences or maybe even death because we were unprepared. And that's a case where taking account of your dreads briefly, I mean, you don't indulge them. You don't waste hours pondering every possible impossibility that might befall you. But anything that you can address productively, you need to think about and address it, because if you don't, then you could be inducing a permanent regret in your life. And as I said last week, regret is something to be avoided. If it's possible for you to anticipate a problem and address it in advance, then this is the right thing to do, because the dread will be forever. If you fail to do this, you thought about it, you say, oh, well, I guess I don't need to worry about that. If you really need to worry about it, then do worry about it and do deal with it, because if you don't, the regret will be terminal. It will be with you till you die. And that's the kind of thing that you want to avoid. A lot of the errors that people make with the subjunctive, I would call errors of idealization, errors of fantasy. The Nirvana fallacy is the name for this in the form of logical fallacies. And what it basically consists of is, you know, postulating conditions that are not in evidence, that don't really exist, and then reasoning about those postulations. And so the classic joke of this is two mathematicians stranded on a desert island, and a can of soup washes ashore, and one of them looks to the other and says, first we postulate a can opener. And it's funny, because obviously they don't have a can opener, and postulating a can opener won't do any good. You will not open a can with a postulated can opener. And this is the kind of thing that we do all the time, is that we are so eager to validate some idea that we have, to conclude that our reasoning is correct, that we fantasize, we idealize a circumstance not in evidence, and then regard that as being dispositive, as being something that will enable us to have what we can't have. Well, all the imaginary cookies in the world will not fill your belly. And so imagining a cookie, or imagining a dozen cookies, or imagining a whole room full of cookies, it doesn't really matter, because they're all 100% imaginary. They don't exist. They can't fill your belly. And this is a kind of an error that you need to watch for. Another one that I run into all the time, I call it the yeah, but fallacy. I will make an argument, and if you have read Man Alive, you have seen the kind of arguments that I can make. I make bulletproof arguments. I go out of my way to make bulletproof arguments, and I've been doing this for 33 years. I've gotten good at it. But I will make what I consider to be a bulletproof argument, and there's always room for quibbling, and I really hate quibbling. I mean, I really hate it, because it is a complete waste of my time. And that's what we get with the yeah, but fallacy. Yeah, but says, yeah, I concede, you're right, but I want to quibble anyway. Well, everything before the comma in a yeah, but is a concession, and everything after the comma in that yeah, but is a quibble. And my answer to this problem, I've run into it all my life, and my answer to it is to take the concession graciously, thank you so much for agreeing with me, and ignore the quibbles entirely. They're your problem. You work it out. Because if we got the yeah, if we got the concession, then the argument that I've made is correct. Not just substantially correct, it is correct. I have told you the truth, and you have agreed that it's the truth. And if you're attempting to quibble after that, then that's a personal problem. That's just something you need to work out on your own. It's probably emotional. It's probably just a matter of disquiet. And the disquiet is probably originating in your appetites rather than in your reasoning. But it really doesn't matter to me, because we have nothing left to argue about. You've already conceded the case. The purpose of going through all of this and to talk about the subjunctive in as many different ways as I can is because the subjunctive is the easiest path to error in human cognition. It is a path to truth, and it is very useful as a path to truth. But you have to go through in your mind every possible way that you can arrive at an error by invoking worlds not in evidence. And if you don't do that, then chances are excellent that you're going to make mistakes. And I have cited logical fallacies, I think probably two Sundays ago, I linked to three or four sites that document logical fallacies. And this is my advice to you, big picture advice. One of the best things you can do for your mind is to study the logical fallacies in detail. I mean, you know, do one a day if you need to. Really do it. And then look for it. And look for it in the things that you read, the things that you see online. Look for those logical fallacies, but just master them. Really learn how to identify errors in other people's arguments. And you still might make mistakes in your own arguments. I know I do. I've done it many times where I have made a specious argument and only months later realized, wow, that was a bogus argument. That was really terrible. There is no there is no escaping. It's selection bias is what it is, that you're always happy to agree with yourself. There is no way around that except by being rigorously careful. But the way that you become more rigorously careful is by learning the habits of rigor, learning how to manage your mind better, to do a better job of identifying errors in general, and you will do, in consequence, a much better job of identifying errors in your own arguments. The reason that I undertook to do all of this now, the reason that I put all my chips on Black 13 now, is that the world is in a perilous state. And I'm not prepared to say the world will end Thursday. I don't believe it's true anyway. I think that, again, I've been doing this for 33 years. I've heard a zillion and one predictions that the world will end Thursday, and it never does. Something always changes. The world is dynamic. The world is full of people, and each one of those people is dynamic. And so you set up a prediction based on, if this continues as it has in the past, this must happen. And that might be a completely plausible conclusion, except that whatever it is you're talking about will not continue as it has in the past. Things will change. The markets are dynamic. The political structure, political apparatus is dynamic. Individual people are dynamic. Companies are dynamic. Every sort of organization that you can name is dynamic. They're all doing different things in response to the world around them. Everything is. Every organism is. I mean, that's in the nature. I mean, the definition of life is responding to changes in your circumstances, responding, one may hope, appropriately, but responding in any case. And so the argument that the world will end Thursday doesn't sway me too much, and yet it is completely plausible to me that the road we're on has to lead to disaster. If we do not reverse our course eventually, soon enough, really, this has to lead to disaster. We cannot continue as we have. We cannot, the national debt or the deficit, the budget deficit in the United States, now equals 100% of the gross national product of the United States. And what that means is that if everybody worked for a year and a day with no compensation, then we could pay down this year's deficit. And that's absurd. It's obvious that we can't continue that way. If you were living that way in your own finances, it would be obvious to you that it couldn't continue. And there's no way that it can continue at the national or international scale either. Sooner or later, something has to give. And obviously, ideally, the best thing would be for us to reverse our course, to go in a different direction and do things differently. That doesn't seem too likely right now, although it's something that I'm actively campaigning for. That's why all my money is on Black 13, because I want us to do things differently. I want for all of us to do things differently. But if that doesn't happen, and if there is a collapse, what might be the consequences? And I am naturally optimistic. It is not in my nature to be dour, to be despairing about anything. And one of the things that I'm particularly excited about, and I want to write more about this in the future because I think it's really, really interesting, is all of the wonderful things that are going on in the East, particularly in India and China, but also in, you know, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan. There are lots and lots, Australia for that matter. The East as we define it, not the Orient, because we're not talking about Oriens. Orientis in Latin means East, but we don't define it that way. We always hear Asian when we hear the word Orient, but it's the East as defined by the globe and also in many cases the Southern Hemisphere. And in fact, the Southern Hemisphere, including Brazil and South Africa, and there are all kinds of interesting things happening south of the equator that we don't pay very much attention to in the United States because we're pretty self-centered and we don't really pay attention to anything. But I'm interested by all of the things that are going on in the Southern Hemisphere and in, you know, the Eastern quadrant of the globe. And these are good reasons to be cheerful, even if the West manages to implode, and it's doing everything it can to implode. You can't fault the governments of the West for not doing everything they can to destroy Western civilization, because they are. They're really good at it, and they practiced for 2,000 years, and by God, they're going to do it for good this time. Well, even if they do, it's not the end of the world. And I am interested in talking about what's going on in the East, and frankly, I'm interested in hearing from people who are exploring the ideas of, you know, capitalism, individualism, egoism in these countries on the make, these countries where they have economic growth, where they're really excited about the possibilities of being alive as a human being. I'm interested in hearing about people, from people and about people who are in that circumstance, because, you know, because it's interesting to me, because it's wonderful, and frankly, because it represents a path of salvation that the West will be able to avail itself of if it should happen to screw things up completely this time. But frankly, the last time this happened, after the fall of Rome, the same condition existed. The Byzantium Empire, the Roman Empire of the East is what it was called at that time. But this was a huge source of intellectual capital for the West when the West was, you know, groveling in pig shit in the Dark Ages. And even with the ascent of Islam, I mean, Islam was no friend to the West. Islam is an anti-Hellenic counter-revolution, that's what it is. But even then, there was so much going on in the Empire of the East that kept the ideas of the West alive when the West was incompetent to do anything, couldn't successfully blow its own nose. And yet those ideas were kept alive, and thanks to the preservation of that knowledge in the East, we were able to dig out, and this is the Renaissance, the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment, etc. This is, thank God, the people in Byzantium were there, because if the Empire of the East had fallen at the same time as the Empire of the West, who knows how long it would have taken us to dig out. And these are not happy ideas to consider. I do understand that. It's not anything that anybody wants to think about or talk about, or certainly not something that anyone would ever hope for or wish for. This is one of my objections to the way that political matters are handled now, is that the people who are best equipped to understand what's going on are so busy lamenting everybody else's sins that they're incapable of practicing anything like virtue. And virtue in this circumstance means marshaling your mental resources, marshaling your intellectual capital, and applying them to the problem that we confront. And nobody is willing to do that. That's what I'm doing. That's why my money is on Black 13. This is what it is that I am doing, is persuading you, talking to you in particular, and persuading you to master the ideas that I'm talking about, to become an egoist in my sense, to become an advocate of self-adoration, of creating a self within your mind that is worthy of your own worship. Which means a whole lot different than what people say when they use the word selfish. Typically what people mean when they use the word selfish is spiteful. And if there's anything spiteful in your behavior, you need to correct that, because that is not to your benefit. That is not to your advantage. You do not love yourself more after behaving spitefully. In fact, you love yourself quite a bit less forever. Because again, you have created an instance of regret in your mind. You've done something that you knew in advance was morally wrong by your own moral standards. And now you have to live with that forever. This is not selfish. This is not self-adoration in the way that I understand it. It's the contrary. It's self-destruction. And I'm opposed to self-destruction in every form. And in particular, I'm opposed to the kind of self-destruction that passes for political rhetoric right now, or philosophical rhetoric, because it's completely useless. It's nothing but a catalog of sins, and an infinite catalog of sins will not create a single virtue. And we don't need to forswear sin. I mean, obviously, we need to forswear sin in order to get better, but that will not consist of getting better. The way that we get better is by doing better, learning better, and doing better. And that's the objective that I seek. And I am highlighting the benefits that we can realize by capitalizing on the things that are going on in the East writ large, because if the West manages to completely screw the pooch, the East will still be there to help us dig our way out. And so I'm interested in talking about that stuff, and I'm interested in hearing from anybody who is working on philosophical problems in the Southern Hemisphere, in the East, you name it, in the places in the world where people are not in despair, where to the contrary, they are excited about the future. I want to hear from you. I have my friend Richard Nicolai, who publishes FreeTheAnimal.com, a wonderful website devoted in the large to paleo living, I guess, especially relating to diet and exercise. But Richard is a big picture kind of guy, and so he's got a big picture blog. But he pointed out to me that Skype, along with a utility called Call Recorder, could be used to record Skype calls side by side. One-on-one, it's not, you know, three or four people, but two people can talk to each other on Skype, and the conversation could be recorded as video. And I'm interested in doing this. I want to do this. It's kind of a halfway stop between me and talk radio, and I don't know that I'm terribly interested in doing talk radio because the time commitment is so huge. Maybe once a week or something like that, I might want to do this if I could get enough people to call in, because I really want to talk to people. I want to talk to people one-on-one. I want to talk to them about their ideas. I want to talk to them about their experiences, about what they've done for real in existential reality, and then talk about what they might do better in the future. And I mean, this is really intrusive on my part, and I do understand that, and I'm not trying to be intrusive. I'm not trying to shame or scorn anybody. To the contrary, I want to help people get better. And if you're interested in talking to me like that, I'm interested in talking to you. And so I, you know, made the appeal on selffederation.com, and there's one person that I'm talking to and another person that I talk to privately about it. Then this is something that I will put into play, you know, very shortly. I want to start doing these. But if you're interested in this, if you're really interested in talking about philosophy, and I mean philosophy in the big picture, especially moral philosophy and the kind of existential and subductive issues that I talk about, psychology, the social sciences, all of the scientific method, the problems of academia. I mean, I don't really care. I want to talk in general, because there's nothing that I can talk about or that you can talk about with me that I won't find interesting. And chances are, if we talk together, we can arrive at answers that are going to be interesting to us and interesting to everybody who watches these videos. And I am aware that video is a great medium for me to discuss ideas, simply because it's so fast, frankly, for me to cover a lot of ground. But also, it's a great way for people to pick up on ideas. And frankly, you can tell by the intense visual variety in these videos that experiencing them by podcast is not going to be any problem for you. You will be able to realize every benefit from watching a podcast that you could, or from listening to a podcast that you could get from watching me on video. Well, I think I'm done. Less than, or just barely 28 minutes. I am so grateful to you for giving me the time to talk about this stuff. And I'm grateful just in general to be able to talk about things like this, because one of the things that I did while I was not putting all my chips on Black 13, basically, was I was censoring myself. I was editing myself. I will talk about ideas like this one-on-one with people, and I, you know, think half the people who meet me think I'm crazy, and maybe all the people who meet me think I'm crazy. And I've dealt with a lot of these ideas in short stories over the years, especially Ramblin' Gamblin' Willie stories, but frankly, everything I've written since I was 19 years old has been related to this idea of the self that I present in Man Alive, one way or another, but it's all pretty subversive. And if you're not really aware of it, frankly, if you've read Man Alive now, if you've read my fiction in the past and you just read Man Alive now, you should go back and read my fiction again, because you'll see a lot more of what I was doing having read Man Alive than will have been obvious to you when you were going through it the first time. But it was a mistake for me to do it that way. I mean, it was interesting to me, it was fun, it was something that I wanted to do, and I knew I didn't want to do the big job in those days, so I did the little job. I did the little job over and over and over again, but that was a mistake, because only the big job matters. And the big job, the bet I have on Black 13 is that human beings are finally ready to understand the self for what it is, to embrace it for what it is, and to respond accordingly, to live self-adoring lives. This is my bet that I'm making. I'm betting that all of humanity, in very short order, can learn how to live self-adoring lives, can completely reverse the course of moral philosophy for all of human history. This is my goal. I mean, how big a bet do I have to make? I have every chip, every idea, everything that I've ever thought about is on black 13. One bet, one square on the board, one little pocket on the roulette wheel, one ball to hit it. That's my bet, is that human beings can learn to do better where they have always, always, always done so badly. I'm betting on you. I'm betting that you can do this, that you will do this, and that as painful as it might be to go through the process, that you'll come through it believing that you've done a real benefit to your life. And I make big promises. I will offer you unlimited human joy. I will offer you splendor. But you have to earn it. I can show you how to do it. But you have to earn it. And that's why I'm talking to you. That's why I'm talking to you week after week after week and going through all of these ideas and going through all of these things that, you know, maybe seem completely obvious to you, or maybe you never thought about them before in your life, but I don't think you've ever thought about them in this way. And I want to teach you this way of thinking, because if you learn to think this way, you can and will achieve splendor. So the name of the website is selfadoration.com. The name of the book is Man Alive, A Survival Manual for the Human Mind. I want you to read it. I want you to read it as many times as necessary. I want you to read, learn, mark, and inwardly digest is what it says in the Bible. I want you to internalize it. I want it to become the way that you think. And if you can learn to think in this way, then you can massively improve your own life. You can improve the lives of your loved ones, of your friends and family, of everyone that you work with, everyone around you. If you share these ideas with the people that you love, their lives will improve too, and everybody's lives will get better. And in no time flat, in 500 days is my goal, but in no time flat, we will be living in a different world, and we can stop worrying about the collapse of the West. Instead, we can put the West on a footing to take on the East and kick its ass. And that's the attitude that we should have. All we need to do is change directions. We've been facing in the wrong direction, not for 2,000 years, but for 10,000 years. We've been facing in the wrong direction. And all we have to do is turn around. Bless you. Thank you so much for your time. You have a great day today and every day. Thank you.